From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. Visit onthemedia.org to find your local public radio station. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away this week. I'm Bob Garfield. Last weekend, a 500,000 people suddenly materialized out of thin airwaves.
El pueblo unido jamás será vencido.
Something is happening on the streets of this country. Something passionate and real and surprising.
How did so many converge to protest immigration legislation when the media had scarcely spoken of the rally beforehand? The answer is that the media were talking about the rally, the Spanish language media. They were all over this story for weeks, under the radar of the Anglo world, but in the center of Latino lives. Just as much of the nation's Hispanic population lives in parallel to mainstream America, so too Hispanic media, which, like the weekend marchers, has revealed itself as a force to be reckoned with. Felix Gutierrez is a professor of journalism at the Annenberg School of Communications at the University of Southern California, and he's been studying Hispanic media for decades. He joins us now. Felix, welcome to OTM.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be with you.
Well, tell me briefly, please, the history of Spanish language media as a rallying force on political questions.
Well, it's a deep history here in Southern California. Last year, we celebrated the 150th anniversary of El Clamor Público, a newspaper literally named the Public Clamor, which was the first Spanish language newspaper here in Southern California. And in the 1850s, they were saying, look, the U.S. has come. They've taken our land. They've made us their citizens. They're lynching us. They're squatting on our lands. We don't have equal rights. Radio has had the same role. In the 1930s, Pedro J. Gonzalez was a predominant radio personality here. This was the time of the repatriations when Mexicans were being rounded up, put on trains going to Mexico during the Depression. And he spoke out on his radio station, actually was sent to San Quentin on trumped-up charges that were later withdrawn because the key witness against him admitted that she had been asked to lie by the district attorney. In the 1950s, with Operation Wetback, which was an Eisenhower administration roundup of Mexicans, you see La Opinion, the Spanish language newspaper here, taking a very different role in covering these issues than the Los Angeles Times. And in the 1970s, with the illegal alien scares, when Attorney General Saxby promised to round up a certain number of illegal aliens by a certain time, you see the Spanish media telling their people, look, here's what they're doing, but here's what your rights are. So take care of yourself and be careful.
Decades ago, Spanish media had a role in mobilizing the community, but it has long since evolved to become a very substantial industry. Tell me about the evolution and just how big Spanish media are, just for example, in Southern California.
Well, I was doing my doctoral dissertation in the early 1970s. I decided to do it on Spanish language radio, and there were two radio stations here at the time in Spanish. And I remember when I went back to campus, one of the faculty members just said, why are you studying that? That's a dying medium. Today, there are 16, at least, radio stations in Spanish in the Los Angeles area. So the media have not died. They've grown. They've grown with the population. But most importantly, they grew because advertisers had an interest in reaching this audience. So they went beyond the ethnic markets, the mom and pop. So the big advertisers now are, you know, McDonald's and the breweries and the same advertisers you see pretty much in English. Spanish language radio used to be a format. It was a medium of chance, not a medium of choice. You listened to the radio station because you preferred Spanish or you only spoke Spanish and you only had one or two choices. Now it's a medium of replicated English language media in that there's a sports talk station, there's oldie stations, reggaeton, banda, rancheros, which is music from the northern part of Mexico, tropicales. So whatever flavor you want in Spanish, you can get it.
in Spanish language media, is there a Rush Limbaugh, a Howard Stern, a 900-pound gorilla?
What you see here is the emergence or reemergence of radio personalities. You listen to so-and-so show. They play music. They have guests who will do interviews. They take calls, tell slightly off-color jokes. But they play a multiple role. They comment on political affairs and current events and such. And that format has become very dominant here, particularly in drive time. So Humberto Luna, El Cucuy, which is another personality, El Piolín, who is the one who's taken credit for mobilizing the other personalities. In this case, they said, let's work together. So there was 11 stations that signed up to say, we're going to promote this as a good civic participation for our people. I think what's different is that this has been a mass mobilization on one day. But over the years, the Spanish language media and other ethnic media have always given you the news and music that you might like from your home country, but also telling you, here's how things work in the United States. And when I was listening to the Spanish language radio last week, they were urging people to participate, but also saying, you know, bring the family, show your best side, don't get drawn into a confrontation. There may be people there who try to provoke us. So it was encouraging people to be there, but to show their best face and not to be the kind of people that we've really been baited into being by some of the English language media. What I'm seeing now is that this is becoming a more balanced debate rather than being the targets and scapegoats of the right-wing talk shows and conservatives, which the undocumented people have been for years. They're speaking out in their own voice, and people are seeing another side of this community that they haven't seen in much of the media over the years.
Felix, thank you very much.
Okay, well, thank you.
Felix Gutierrez is a professor of journalism at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Southern California. While much has been made of the way the immigration debate has been covered on either side of the language divide in the United States, it pales in comparison to the difference between coverage of the issue in the United States and Mexico. For many in the U.S., the restrictions proposed by the Sensenbrenner bill have come to the fore this week with the demonstrations and congressional coverage, but in Mexico, where an election season is in full swing, the issues have been brewing for months. Hector Tobar is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times, stationed in Mexico City. He's written about the impact of the border on the coverage of immigration issues, and he joins us now. Hector, welcome to OTM.
Thank you for having me. Hello.
As we speak, President Bush is in Cancun, Mexico, at a NAFTA summit with Mexican President Vicente Fox and Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper. How is the Bush visit in the midst of all this immigration debate playing in the media right now?
Well, here in Mexico, it's seen as the last opportunity for Vicente Fox to make good on one of the promises from early in his presidency, which was that he would somehow deliver the whole enchilada of immigration reform. That was the expression used then, that there would be a program whereby there would be amnesty or some sort of amnesty for people who live in the United States who are illegal immigrants. That has been dead in the water ever since September 11th, and people were really heartened here by the proposal that came forth from the Senate Judiciary Committee earlier this month that would allow sort of form for people who are illegal in the United States to get their naturalization and to become guest workers. So I think people are following it very closely. There's a lot of skepticism here about what Fox can deliver. He's seen by many Mexicans as a good-meaning but weak leader.
In the United States, there are essentially two poles of thought about illegal immigration. One is that it's a net boon to the United States because it provides low-priced labor and all of the advantages of the great melting pot. The other side says that it's a vast drain on resources and that the illegal immigrants steal jobs from citizens. I'm curious, in Mexico, is there anything like a consensus on this issue? Is there a school of thought there that says illegal immigration to the States is actually not so great for Mexico?
I think the focus here tends to be on the treatment that Mexicans receive in the United States and how each Mexican who goes to the States represents national pride. And every time that there is an incident on the border in which a border crosser is killed or a group of border crossers die, it reinforces the image of Mexicans as victimized when they go to the North. When a legislation is put forward in the United States that would criminalize them even further, that really is the focus of what the coverage is. There are only really a minority of voices who say that, in fact, immigration to the United States is a greater threat to Mexican national identity than it is to American national identity, and that the safety valve that currently exists here, whereby the poorest of the poor and the most desperate can leave and thereby liberate Mexican society of the need to feed them and to educate them, that can't remain open forever. We are going to have to deal with the root social and economic causes of migration eventually, and we better start doing it sooner rather than later.
As we discussed, you're in the middle of an election season there, three major parties vying for the presidency and other spoils. To what extent have the candidates tried to exploit the immigration issue in their media campaigns? Is there any symbolism or imagery that's being invoked by the candidates to take best advantage of the public sentiment in support of the paisanos?
The image that comes up again and again in the rhetoric is the image of the wall. You know, the idea, even though, of course, the wall might never be built, it's just a proposal, the idea that the United States could build another 700 miles of fencing and try to seal itself off, as the argument goes here, is something that really hits home. It's a very visceral issue for Mexicans. It's been referred to as a kind of Berlin Wall. It's been compared to the Great Wall of China. And so that metaphor has worked its way into a lot of campaign speeches. You know, what are we going to do as a country in the face of this power next to us, the United States?
Apart from invoking symbols like the wall, how much coverage is there of the life north of the border?
Well, as you say, coverage of what is happening with Mexicans north of the border, the pan de cada día, the daily bread of the Mexican media here, all the newspapers have correspondents, not just in Washington, but also in Los Angeles, which is sort of like the capital of Mexicans in the United States. When the student walkouts and then the big demonstration took place over the weekend in Los Angeles, it was something that was covered extensively by all the newspapers and the television stations and the radio stations. All the Mexican newspapers ran that photograph of Los Angeles City Hall surrounded by a multitude on their front page. And the television stations, many of them ran interviews with people in the marches talking about, you know, Viva la Raza, Long Live the Race. The Latino neighborhoods and communities in the United States are seen as an extension of what it means to be a Mexican. And so it was covered as the milestone in civil rights for the paisanos north of the border.
All right. Well, Hector, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a great pleasure.
Hector Tobar is the Mexico City Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times and author of Translation Nation, Defining a New American Identity in the Spanish-Speaking United States. Coming up, a Mexican columnist explodes stereotypes and European filmmakers take on immigration. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. For many Americans, the debate about immigration, more specifically south of the border immigration, conjures up images of young Mexican men gathered on neighborhood street corners waiting for day labor. Even beyond those images, a conversation about Mexican-American culture is, for most of us, likely to remain stuck in stereotype and cliché. No one knows this better than Gustavo Arellano, a reporter for the OC Weekly in Orange County, California. For more than a year, Arellano has written a column called Ask a Mexican, in which he answers questions from readers ranging from thoughtful to profane. Gustavo, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
Okay, first of all, Ask a Mexican, Gustavo? sounds like a minefield of all sorts of racial politics and God knows what all.
It's meant to be inflammatory, and the column runs with a picture of the stereotypical Mexican that's been in the mind of Americans for 150 years, that of a fat male with a sombrero, a gold tooth, and a mustache. And we're doing that specifically to engage readers into challenging all the stereotypes that are out there about Mexicans.
Did this begin as a gag, a serious enterprise? How did it all come to pass?
What happened was my boss saw a billboard of a Mexican radio DJ wearing a Viking helmet with his eyes crossed. He comes back to the office and tells me, "I saw the greatest billboard ever. This man looks like as if he could answer any questions about Mexicans. Why don't you start a column called Ask a Mexican where you'll field questions from readers?" And we were only supposed to do it as a one-time only gag because we had to fill the news hole that week. So I wrote a question. I made it up for myself. It was, "Dear Mexicans, why do Mexicans call white people gringos?" And I responded, "Mexicans don't call gringos gringos. Only gringos call gringos gringos. Mexicans call gringos gabachos." And
which
we thought,
I gather is true. Gabachos is the term of art.
Absolutely. So we did it one time. We figured, okay, it's a joke. People will laugh and that's it. The week it published, we received an overwhelming response, 50-50 both amongst Latinos and whites or gabachos, that they liked it or they thought it was racist. More surprisingly, though, we actually started receiving questions from people. And they still keep coming in every week, about 15 to 20 questions a week.
What have you learned doing Ask a Mexican?
I learned that we remain the perpetual other of the United States. Ask a Mexican, I view ultimately as an indictment of the American mind and how it, for whatever reason, cannot accept Mexicans ever becoming Americans. The fact that this column exists truly is a joke. And the fact that I have to answer these questions is ridiculous. That said, I will answer these questions to confront all of those stereotypes and really the pitiful nature of the American mind that cannot accept Mexicans being in this country. And I don't think they ever will. We're always going to remain the perpetual other.
Now, as you set out to explode these stereotypes, I gather you discovered a sort of paradox. There's the one stereotype of Mexicans as extraordinarily hardworking people desperate to earn a living in the States and send money back to their families south of the border, the most motivated immigrants. And then there's the other one of the lazy, shiftless, fat guy in the sombrero picking his teeth and getting ready for yet another nap. Which trumps the other?
As you could tell with the Sensenbrenner bill and all the legislation that's trying to crack down on Mexicans coming into this country ostensibly to work, the image that's really out there is that of the hardworking Mexican, the hardworking Mexican that works so hard, in fact, that he's going to ruin American society.
Here's a kind of a ticklish one. There are a bunch of Mexican and Latino and Latina media personalities and writers and columnists operating in this country. But you suggest that they often trade in the very stereotypes that you're out to debunk.
A lot of these Latino columnists in daily newspapers across the country, they do use stereotypes, but in their case, they're all positive stereotypes. So they do stories about the immigrant woman who came here to this country as a single mom, but yet she's making it, or the illegal immigrant college student who has no funds and can't apply for financial aid. But nevertheless, he's working five jobs and so forth. I think, sure, those stories exist. But if you want to have a nuanced view of a society, you need to talk about the good and the bad. If you only talk about the bad, you get nothing. If you only talk about the good, you get nothing. You need to talk about the good and bad. And I really don't think a lot of Latino journalists want to talk about the bad because they feel they have the responsibility to only talk about the good. But in doing that, it's really a disservice to a Mexican or Latino society or culture, or especially in the depictions of Latinos in the media.
All right, Gustavo. Now I want to ask a Mexican.
Okay.
If you had one idea that you can impart to white America about Mexico and its culture and its people and the illegal Mexican immigrants living here, what would it be?
I would give them the example of my father. He came to this country illegally in 1968 in the trunk of a Chevy with three other men. And now, you know, he became a citizen, and now he's against illegal immigration. If that's not assimilation, I don't know what is.
All right. Well, Gustavo, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Gustavo Arellano is an investigative reporter, food critic, and author of the column Ask a Mexican for the OC Weekly. The problems of assimilation, ghettoization, and crippling stereotypes are not limited to Mexicans living in the United States. In the democracies of Western Europe, millions of Muslim immigrants and their second and third generation progeny also know the experience of being strangers at home. The clash of cultures has been tragically evident lately with the protests over Danish cartoon images of the Prophet Muhammad, and before that, the murder of Dutch filmmaker Theo van Gogh, who was slain for perceived slights against Islam in his 2004 movie Submission. Such violence has historically liberal societies struggling with their basic values, struggles increasingly reflected in art. At the Berlin Film Festival in February, at least three movies from three different countries addressed this internal divide. Los Angeles Times reporter Jeffrey Fleischman lives in Berlin and attended the festival. He joins me now with his impressions. Jeffrey, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
In your story, you called Europe the cultural ground zero of Muslim frustration. Okay, I get the Muslim frustration part. I get the ground zero. Why the cultural one particularly?
Well, what's been happening here is for decades. There's been this population, no matter where you go in Europe, of immigrants, and many of them came over as guest workers. As the years passed, they failed to sort of penetrate the barrier, some of them consciously put up and some of them not. Now, probably more than in the United States, the Muslim population in Europe is wondering, how can we integrate and keep our identity and keep our mosque and even our call to prayer echoing out over European neighborhoods? How can we have this, but at the same time become democratic citizens of the West? That's the problem right now, and that's what some of these films are trying to address, I think.
Before I ask you about the films themselves, I just want to get a better idea of what these immigrant communities are like. Is it more like the black urban ghetto, or maybe like Little Italy or Chinatown in L.A.?
In Berlin, for example, you have a number of neighborhoods that are almost strictly Turkish. And you cross into these neighborhoods knowing that you're in a European city, but at the same time, you cross a barrier, and part of it could be akin to something like Little Italy. But it's almost more closed off than that, because many of the Turks here, now into their second and third generation, can exist in this pocket without speaking German, without really bumping into anybody in three or four or five or six or ten blocks where they have to really interact with another culture. And one Turkish leader told me a little while ago that the problem in Europe is that, at least from the Muslim perspective, the non-acceptance has been so deep that they've retreated back into the cultural ethos and patterns and religious beliefs of where they came from 30 or 40 years ago on the plains of Anatolia, and that actually in some neighborhoods in Berlin, the customs are more traditional and more rural than actually in Turkey itself, which I found quite interesting, but a stroll through the neighborhoods reaffirms that.
Now this year, you found three films at the festival that, to one degree or another, had to do with Muslim dislocation. One of them, by Dutch filmmaker Martin Koolhoven, was actually a comedy. Clash of Civilizations sounds like a barrel of laughs, was it?
Schnitzel Paradise was a film that took place in the Netherlands in a hotel kitchen with a staff of a Serb, Moroccans, a number of various Muslims, and Dutch. And all these were kind of commingled in their own pot. So he sort of used the kitchen as an analogy for the multiculturalism trying to exist in the Netherlands today. And it was quite comic. There were a lot of quips and asides about race and culture and things like that. And the narrative went towards sort of a West Side Story kind of thing, if you will, between a Moroccan dishwasher and a waitress. And around that, depending on who they were, whether the Moroccan or the Turk or the Dutch, became worried in their own sort of cultural way of how this would work out. Would the Moroccan dishwasher, whose father wanted him to be a doctor, would he disappoint him by running off with this young blonde-haired woman? And then the flip side of that, of course, is would her family even accept him? So it dealt with all these issues that are happening today, but it did it in a very light sense.
What struck me most about that was that Koolhoven is Dutch, and writing on these themes in the wake of the murder of Dutch filmmaker Theo van Gogh, who was killed by Muslim extremists for, from their perspective, somehow disrespecting Islam in a film of his. Did Koolhoven take care not to tread on Muslim sensitivities?
When the murder of Van Gogh happened, it sent a ripple completely through the artistic community and the film community, not only of the Netherlands, but all of Europe, because it was the case of, if we're going to explore things culturally, how far can we do it? And Van Gogh's film Submission, which dealt with the oppression, the rape, and the forced marriage of Muslim women as its thesis, really offended the more conservative Muslim elements. And so the outrage was palpable, and Koolhoven told me that he thought about his script and who are we going to offend. For example, he was having problems even casting a Moroccan dishwasher because many Muslims did not want to kiss on film because they thought it was against Muslim humility and they didn't want to offend their families. So even on the set, they still had to reach certain levels of understanding on how far they could go. And then he felt if we do it honestly and truthfully and with good-natured humor, then we shouldn't be afraid to do this.
Another film at the festival came from Denmark, a country itself only too well acquainted with the kind of hostile reaction to content that killed Van Gogh, in this case, the editorial cartoons depicting Muhammad.
Yes, I think the Danish film, which is called One on One, was the most profound of the films that dealt with these issues. The opening of the film was the unfurling of blueprints for what the Danes were considering the perfect housing project. But as the blueprints were stripped away and you were dropped into the reality of this city, you saw that all those social democratic ideals that Scandinavians are so proud of were really being challenged by what was happening on the ground in those apartments. And in this story, you had a young Danish girl with her Palestinian boyfriend. And her brother, quickly, as the film opens, one night he is beaten into a coma. And so within this tension, pulling both sides, you see the young Danes who are the victim's friends automatically thinking it has to be a darkie, as they say it. But it asks all these questions from so many different angles. For example, the mother of the son who was beaten is a social worker. So she subscribed to this utopian theory, and she wouldn't leave the housing projects as all the other whites did. And then in one very poignant scene, she's out walking, just trying to contemplate what has happened to her son. And the camera takes in this wonderful swirl of a woman, blonde hair and blue-eyed, standing amidst black chadors and headscarves and all these billowing things of another world, but they are of her world. And so she's asking questions, did I do the right thing? Can this work? And the film continues to ask that in very different ways.
Maybe the most unnerving of the films that showed up at Berlin this year was I don't know if it's a documentary, more of a docudrama, called Hamburg Lectures. Tell me about it.
Hamburg Lectures was directed by Romano Carmacher, and what he basically did was, on January 3rd and 5th of the year 2000, in the Al-Quds Mosque, where Muhammad Atta and some of the other September 11th hijackers frequented, there were two lectures given by Mohammed Fazazi, who was a sort of a mentor to Atta and the others. And these lectures were taped. But what he did was he took the direct text from both those lectures, and he sat down a German actor who had glasses sliding down his nose like he was reading some kind of sinister fairy tale, and just recite these in a very deadpan manner. At the beginning of the film, you're getting all these arcane descriptions of when the moon is full, when should we fast, can a woman flying from the Middle East to Europe fly unaccompanied, or is that a violation of the Quran? You're starting to wonder, well, what is he driving at here? What's going on? And then slowly, through this rhetoric, through this labyrinth, and then slowly using the Quran and quoting from that, you begin to hear jihad. And so gradually, the rope begins to tighten around the pole, and you can see, even in the very deadpan delivery of the actor who's looking straight at the camera, the power of words and the power of thought on young, disillusioned men, and how they can be guys like Moroccan cooks in Schnitzel Paradise and be twisted and turned another way.
Well, that leads me to my final question, and this one will require some guesswork from you. These films, which ostensibly aim to address these nagging questions of isolation and assimilation, do you suppose they will help forge some sort of cultural understanding?
I think we'll probably see more attempts like these, and it will depend on, I think, the quality and the subtlety of the writing. One of the positive things that hasn't been talked about a lot in the Danish cartoons thing is that, for the most part, Muslims in Europe handled their disdain and their disgust for the cartoons in a Western democratic way. They protested, they petitioned governments, they marched in the street, but there was very little violence and very little outrage. It was only after that was co-opted by the Middle East was it turned into something more combustible. So I think by being in Europe for so long that the Muslim community is trying to say, hey, we need to fit in here. We need our ideals to be respected, but at the same time, we have to learn how to bend into a larger Western democracy.
Well, Jeff, thank you very much.
Okay.
Jeffrey Fleischman reports from Germany for the Los Angeles Times. And now for a few of your letters. There was quite a bit of response to our segment on FCC indecency standards. Most writers applauded our conversations with FCC Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein and TV producer Stephen Bochco, conversations punctuated by some of the very curse words at issue. On our broadcast, we bleeped over the fine-worthy vocabulary, but some listeners were still disgusted. Brenda King writes, "My father always said that profanity is a sign that there is not efficient vocabulary to use a real word. I was offended by that announcer's language, beeps or no." Mike Rainville of Lincoln, Vermont, said that, listening to the segment, quote, "I reached a point where I could no longer stomach Bob Garfield's gratuitous, sophomoric, and unentertaining use of coarse language. I shut the radio off, not because I was offended, but because I don't need it. The world doesn't need it." On the other hand, Andy Cowenhoven of Concord, New Hampshire wrote, "Thanks for your outspoken handling of this subject. If you get fined, I'm good for a few bucks. Thanks for the comments and offers of cash. If you have more, write to us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. Coming up, the President of the United States asks you over to chat, do you send your regrets? And judges are under attack in the no-spin zone. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. The president has been meeting informally with reporters who cover the White House. Don't look for accounts of those conversations in your local paper or on the news, however, because they're strictly off the record. Begging the question, what's the point? Ron Hutchison is a Knight Ridder reporter and former president of the White House Correspondents Association. He's here to articulate the thinking behind chatting or not chatting on the president's terms. Hutch, welcome back to OTM.
Hey, Bob, how are you?
Well, thank you. So all of this, I guess, is pretty academic for you since you weren't invited to talk to the president off the record. First of all, why not? I mean, is it your coverage, bad blood, your breath? What?
I don't know, Bob. I wish I knew, but I'm not going to the prom, evidently.
But had you been invited, what would have been your call on this one?
Yeah, we just talked about it here at the Knight Ridder Washington Bureau with my editors the other day and basically decided that if I am invited into one of these sessions, that I'll just take a pass on it. I hasten to add, I don't criticize anybody for going.
What is the president up to here, or what is any president up to when he wants to speak off the record to the press?
And I think in this case, I think this is pretty clearly part of the administration's recent efforts to offer reassurances about the war in Iraq. I think he's particularly interested in meeting with some people that he doesn't know as well, because he is a charming, affable fella in private, in person, but you don't really see that side of him when he's in the stage setting.
Okay, now, the press corps in Washington typically and historically has gone to off-the-record briefings with secretaries of state, with defense secretaries who are identified only as, you know, high administration officials and so forth. Why should it be different with the president if he wants to go back channel?
First point is, why should we be playing that game to begin with? I mean, in a large group setting, it seems to me there's really not much excuse for not doing it with attribution. And I, in fact, led a spectacularly unsuccessful walkout when a senior administration official refused to be identified by name. I got outside the room, looked behind me, and there was nothing there but air. But so we've been trying to discourage it altogether. But I've always said, you know, never say never, because there clearly are times when somebody needs the cloak of anonymity and the information is worth it.
Now, that argument didn't prevail at your news organization. It didn't prevail at the New York Times, which has declined to participate. You were quick to not criticize your colleagues who are taking the president up on his offer. Tell me why you shouldn't be rolling your eyes and thumbing your nose at those guys.
I think the calculus is there's something to be gained for the readers. Take, for example, the one area that I've always felt that there's some justification for. Going off the record is kind of hard, but at least for not attribution, are sensitive diplomatic areas. Now, I would love to hear what President Bush has to say in private right now about Vladimir Putin. If he thinks that Putin is one big scumbag, he clearly cannot say that in public. I'd love to hear what he says, because if the one hand he says, oh, you know, I've still looked in his soul and I think he's a wonderful man, well, that tells me something. But if he says, you know, I am just about fed up to hear what that fella, that tells me something. And either way, it'll inform me the next time I see the two of them together, and I can't sit down and write about it. But I think I could give somehow a more accurate presentation to the readers that I might not otherwise be able to give, or I could at least use it to try to pry information out of somebody else.
Could you, or would you be all informed up with no place to go? I mean, you...
That's also quite possible. I, you know, that's the big who knows. And it could also be that this is all about, you know, let me show you the Truman balcony and the Lincoln bedroom and, you know, the little tour that he likes to give people in the Oval Office where he shows off the rug. And, you know, if that's it, well, you know, the only benefit is to your ego and the readers don't get anything out of it. It's a big fat waste of time and it'd be by any measure a big mistake.
Among those who accepted this invitation are Stephen Dinan from The Washington Times, the Associated Press, David Borman from CNN. Conspicuous by its absence, The New York Times, which has said it's boycotting. The fact that The Times is not going to participate, do you think that will give other organizations the courage to stand up against the White House attempts at glad-handing?
You know, if anything, it's the opposite, because there's the feeling that, well, The Times isn't going, but they have access to top administration officials that some of the rest of us do not have just because of who they are. So, you know, there's an element of, oh, well, they can afford not to go, but man, oh, man, this is my one chance to get, you know, some FaceTime with the president.
So when it comes to your job of informing the, you know, many millions of readers of Knight Ridder newspapers around this country, you can't win for losing.
Sometimes it seems that way, that's for sure.
Ron Hutchison is a Knight Ridder reporter and former president of the White House Correspondents Association. All the best. Bye-bye.
It's an interesting topic. Bye. We'll be right back.
Here's a shocker. Bill O'Reilly of the Fox News Channel was outraged. An irresponsibly lenient judge had let a child rapist off practically scot-free.
Hi, I'm Bill O'Reilly. Thanks for watching us tonight. Kids are Americans, too. That is the subject of this evening's Talking Points memo. I have one simple question because, as you know, I am a simple guy. If a man confessed to raping two American women, adults, do you believe that man would be sentenced to probation anywhere in this country? The answer, of course, is no. That wouldn't happen because if it did, every women's group, every media outlet would demand the removal of the judge. Yet in Ohio, a man who confessed to orally raping a 5-year-old boy and an 11-year-old boy over and over was sentenced to probation by Judge John Connor.
O'Reilly concluded that Connor was unfit for service on the bench. And the next thing you know, both the governor of Ohio, Republican Robert Taft, and the state's attorney general were calling for impeachment. Only problem was, and here's another shocker, O'Reilly had the story completely wrong. The defendant never pleaded guilty to rape, and there were further inaccuracies, as Franklin County, Ohio Common Pleas Judge Connor himself explains.
Well, for one thing, they make probation sound like, or he made it sound like, this guy was walking the street. That wasn't true. He was on house arrest. He wasn't permitted to go outside his house except for either reporting to the probation officer, which he did once a week, or for treatment. You know, he wanted to traumatize his viewers and make it sound as horrible as he could so they would be outraged, and obviously he accomplished his purpose.
What happened to you in the ensuing days and weeks?
First of all, I couldn't talk, you know, because it was still a pending case. But the mischaracterizations or misrepresentations, which basically Mr. O'Reilly started, were starting to be picked up by the local press. So I felt compelled at some point to get on and at least straight out the public record.
At one point, you ordered up a transcript of the hearing testimony from psychologists in the case to refresh your memory. A transcript that was available to the press, but did the press in reporting the story ever actually go to the source?
My court reporter said she got many calls for the transcript, and she didn't know who they were, or some of them might have been media. She wasn't specific, but she said as soon as she told them the price, they said forget it, and nobody ordered. The Columbus Dispatch did order it and did pay for it. And by the way, as soon as they had it, wrote a very good, fair, and accurate article about the case.
So you get out of your car one day, and it turns out Fox News has staked out your house. What was that like?
They started asking me questions. Isn't it true you could have sentenced him to 10 years? And I said, I'm sorry, I can't talk to you. Why don't you talk to us? And then I said, well, because you never tell the truth. And they said, well, tell me what we didn't tell the truth about. And I said, about anything. And then I got in my car and left.
So let me ask you this. You went through this ordeal.
Yeah.
For exercising your judicial discretion in a case in which you were substantially hamstrung as to what to do, actually. Does this not make you think twice about any kind of decision that would smack of leniency?
Not at all. Let me just tell you this. I had 24 sentencings yesterday, and the press was there with cameras, and I didn't do anything any different than I didn't normally do. And if I were going to do something different, I would certainly do it with the press there.
Do you think that your colleagues on the bench in Ohio have nothing further to fear from talk show hosts and politicians eager to make hay out of a kind of populist issue like judicial leniency?
Nobody has to fear Mr. O'Reilly. I think his credibility is zip. And in terms of this impeachment, I don't think it'll ever happen again. I think we can get a positive out of this. I think the separation of powers, the legislative, executive, and the judicial is safe now and for some time to come.
Well, Judge Connor, thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Connor is a common pleas court judge in Franklin County, Ohio. Though he believes his media martyrdom freed his colleagues and successors from fear, not everyone agrees. Ohio Supreme Court Chief Justice Thomas J. Moyer says cable TV crucifixions cannot but inhibit judges from handing down potentially unpopular decisions.
I heard, it was secondhand, but I heard from a judge that essentially if you think this threat of impeachment or removal doesn't have an effect on the sentencing that's going to occur tomorrow or the next day, you're wrong. And that's very unfortunate. Now, hopefully that gets washed away eventually. because we avoided a real collision here. But I think there's no question that if the judge here had been removed from office, there's no question that judges would have feared that in a very tangible way.
Ohio Chief Justice Thomas J. Moyer is a member of Justice at Stake, a Washington, D.C.-based public interest group promoting judicial independence. That group's executive director is Bert Brandenburg, who says that the Republicans' current fixation on the supposedly out-of-control judiciary is just the latest such cycle in the nation's long political history.
Well, there's certainly nothing new about criticizing judges, and they shouldn't be above criticism. They're public servants, and they have to be accountable for their work. And if you look historically through American history, you see cycles in which courts have come under more attack, and we happen to be in one of those cycles right now. However, what's different these days is that there is an outrage industry out there that seeks to, number one, perpetuate this cycle, and number two, really try to redefine what people think about courts by distorting their work. You get the emotional, gut-wrenching situation where there's a criminal case usually, and either someone has committed a horrible crime or they're accused of committing a horrible crime, and the judge didn't, quote-unquote, make the right decision. And essentially, you try to turn the judge into the villain, and you try to make them look like they're as out of the mainstream as you can.
In order for these appeals to the public to work properly and for the outrage to be incited, it seems to me that whoever the broadcaster is has to, you know, leave out all of the nuance and backstory and mitigating circumstances that caused the judge to render whatever decision he or she rendered to begin with.
Unfortunately, the work of the courts is amongst the most vulnerable parts of professional life to distortion through compression, in the sense that the more you leave out what led to the decision you don't like, the more you truly distort what happened in the first place. And you don't really expect a cable newscaster to sit there and read a decision out loud at the Supreme Court. And so as a result, you have situation after situation where somebody doesn't like the decision. You never hear a word about how it got there. There's some good news in the sense that the internet is available to post decisions for people who have a chance to go to read them. However, since most people get most of their news from cable and local TV, you get this 3 to 5 second version or maybe a minute or two on just how angry people are about the decision. And then you move on, and all you think is that this judge must be sitting around figuring out how to screw over the American people.
Your organization is called Justice at Stake. Is it really? I mean, what are the consequences of this kind of outrage inciting?
There are three ways in which these attacks, I think, can be particularly harmful to the courts. One is that you're essentially setting up a situation where you're demonizing and undercutting the legitimacy of the courts in the eyes of the public. You're also trying to intimidate judges by calling for their impeachment, or if you can't impeach them, trying to get decisions made that would be different if there wasn't public pressure. And then finally, this does lead to attempts to overturn checks and balances by simply stripping power from the courts. We actually saw an interesting case study last year with the Schiavo case. And that actually had, from this perspective, a reasonably happy ending. I'm not talking about the underlying issue of what to do with Terri Schiavo's situation, but you had this incredible overreaching that the media, which dwelt on the case for 3 to 4 weeks, it was kind of wall-to-wall coverage, emboldened interest groups to press Congress and the president to the point where it became the law of the United States. And it was only because of the reaction by the American people saying, no, don't do this, that you had this correcting factor. It's not that it was the media's fault, but if it hadn't been for the media's role in the Schiavo case, I'd be very surprised if the Schiavo law would have been signed in the first place.
There's another cable TV phenomenon I want to ask you about because it seems similar, if not directly related, to what we've been discussing. And that is this pro-prosecution, demonize the defendant, cable talk programming that focuses on criminal cases around the country, Nancy Grace and the like. Tell me what this does to the climate for judicial independence.
Well, cable TV is a very populist medium, and populism is often used to target in particular criminal cases so that judges are constantly seen as non-populist. Unaccountable is the accusation. And in the populist frame, the idea of balancing independence and accountability doesn't really enter the picture. You're just mad about that latest decision, and look how outrageous the conduct of the defendant was. In terms of the impact on the independence of the courts, the great fear is that if you get more and more cable hosts and radio hosts and others competing to be the angriest at the courts in order to get the best ratings, that at some point you either get judges intimidated or you get Congress or a state legislature feeling emboldened that they can actually start stripping powers away from the courts. You know, courts should be able to survive some hazing and some inaccurate and unfair commentary. That's fine. But if it gets to a certain level where it's so constant, then there is a risk down the road that it will lead to a weakening in the power of the courts.
What would you do about this, counselor? You know, put a muzzle on Bill O'Reilly or what?
Well, this is America. Nobody needs to be muzzled. However, judges can do more to speak out. They are famously shy to do so. Bar associations and bar leaders who know what's going on and who are often respected, law school deans can speak out. But there's a case to be made here for old-fashioned civic education. If you teach more and more people about how the courts actually work, they are less likely to be susceptible to these types of attack, essentially watering down the ground in advance. 10 to 20 years from now, a generation from now, we're more likely to have a citizenry that's less receptive to these type of demagogic attacks.
Well, Bert, thank you very much.
Absolutely. Glad to do it.
Bert Brandenburg is executive director of the Justice at Stake campaign, a nonpartisan advocacy group in Washington, D.C.
I do know one thing. American kids these days are targets. They have few defenders in the press, no political clout, and a society that is not engaged in protecting them. Factor viewers and listeners are the only national group that I know of looking out for the kids.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had help from Mark Phillips and Ani Katz. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org. And email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. Brooke Gladstone, I'm delighted to report, will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the Foundation of Entrepreneurship. On the web at kauffman.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, continuing support of individual creativity with the announcement of new MacArthur Fellows on September 20th. Support from the media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. On the Media is also supported by Live from Lincoln Center. On April 3rd, Live from Lincoln Center broadcast the Juilliard School, celebrating 100 years featuring Renee Fleming, Emmanuel Axe, Kevin Kline, and performers from the Juilliard School. Local listings available at pbs.org. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science. Neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.